Okay, I will call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:36 PM on Friday, February 18th, 2022, and present today. We've got a number of folks who are on the phone. I'm just going to call out everyone's names here. Representative Thompson, are you there? Representative Carpenter? Representative LeBon?
I'd be here.
Okay, thank you. Representative LeBon is here. Representative Ortiz, I'm sorry, Representative Ortiz?
I'm here, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Representative Edgman? And Co-Chair Merrick is here in the room. Representative Rasmussen? Representative Joseph? Oh, Representative Rasmussen's online. And Representative Josephson is also
sorry,
here.
Sorry, I'm here, Mr. Co-Chair. I just got unmuted.
Oh, thank you. Representative Rasmussen's online, and Representative Josephson's here in the room. Representative Wool? Representative Johnson? Okay, and myself, Co-Chair Foster, is here in the room. So as we start, just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones, and today we'll have an overview from the Department of Law and an overview for the judiciary. And so up first is the Department of Law, and here to present we have Deputy Attorney General John Skidmore with Criminal Division, and Deputy Attorney General Corey Mills with the Civil Division. And if you could both put yourselves on the record, and thank you for joining us. And if you would like to go ahead and jump right in.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, sitting here at council, or council table. At the table with me is Corey Mills, who is the Deputy Attorney General for the Civil Division. The slides that you have in front of you here, this first slide is the sort of title slide, if you will. Obviously, it lists our Attorney General, Treg Taylor. He sends his regards. He wished he could be here today. Health reasons, unfortunately, prevented him from appearing here in person with us. I'm going to move to the next slide, which is really describes the mission for the Department of Law. Really is to provide legal services to state government, as well as to prosecute crimes. And then on slide three, you really get a view of our management team here. You, of course, have the Attorney General, Treg Taylor, myself, Deputy Attorney General Mills, and then you have the three divisions that actually exist within the Department of Law. Most people remember that we have a criminal division and we have a civil division. They often forget we also have an administrative division. That's headed up by Amber LeBlanc, who, if I'm not mistaken, is available on the phone today for questions as well. But that administrative services division is critical for us, because we wouldn't be able to do the work we do without their support. And we're pretty proud of them, because I think we actually have one of the smallest percentages of admin support to actual department size.
Yeah, and if I could just note that Representative Edgman is also with us. Please continue. Thank you.
Thank you. The other two divisions that we have are the Criminal Division and the Civil Division. You'll note from last year we've actually had changes in our administrative team, senior management team. You have Angie Kemp, who is the new director for the Criminal Division. She is replacing Jack McKenna, who was appointed to the bench. Angie has been with the Criminal Division now for over 15 years and was most recently the district attorney here in Juneau, and was just in the last month elevated to be the director for the Criminal Division. And on the civil side, we have Stacy Crayley, who's the new director of the Civil Division. She is replacing Joanne Grace, who retired from state service after 30-plus years of service to the state. Ms. Crayley brings over 22 years of experience with the Department of Law and 25 years with the state. So we're fortunate to have two such highly qualified individuals step up to take on leadership roles for us. But this first slide in the very beginning, where we talk about management, really helps to illustrate the challenges that the department faces in recruitment and retention. We lose very good people to those sorts of situations, retirement and moving on to other positions like being appointed to the bench. The next slide is really the two requests that the department has in its budget this year. The first, you all, of course, will know from last year that you added a number of positions to the Criminal Division. There were 19 positions overall, and as is normal, when new positions are added, the budget provided 75% of the funding for those positions. Our only request this year is to simply round out the additional 25% so that we have the money to pay those folks in the next fiscal year. The second request we have is really from the Civil Division, and that's a request for an additional $4 million in a multi-year appropriation to deal with statehood defense issues. I'm not going to go into much more depth about that other than to say that Deputy Attorney General Mills will be addressing that a little later in this presentation in more specifics.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Edgman.
So, welcome, Mr. Skidmore. It's been actually a couple years, I think, since you've been here.
Yes, sir.
With 2021 in the rearview mirror. So, 19 new prosecutors and support full-time positions. How's the recruitment going for that, and how's things expected to sort of play out? Because what I recall last, maybe perhaps the last time you were at the table, is that wasn't maybe not an uphill battle, but it was not going to be a guarantee that you were going to actually be able to fill those positions.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, it's almost like you've read my slides ahead of time, because we're going to talk more about that. But the short answer to your question, sir, is that we have filled 8 of the 10 prosecutor positions and all 9 of the support staff positions. But while there is a success story in filling those new positions, that doesn't necessarily equate to we don't still have ongoing recruitment and retention issues. And I promise you, we will talk a little bit more about that in just a moment.
Okay, please continue.
So the next slide we had here is just the slide that provides the overview of the department's budget from FY19 through the request for FY23. It's relatively flat during that period of time, but since we're in the Finance Committee, it's usually a good idea to show you guys what's going on with the budget there. The next slide is really where we're going to get into the specifics for the Criminal Division. We have 2 or 3 slides in which I'll go through those things, and then I'll turn this over to my colleague, Deputy Attorney General Mills, to discuss Civil Division. For the Criminal Division, our mission is, we say, to prosecute crimes. It's really about seeking justice as we do so, to promote public safety and to further the respect for government through prompt, effective, and compassionate prosecution of cases. We always like to remind folks that there are some things that we don't do so that people don't get confused. We do not actually prosecute any federal crimes. We do not prosecute municipal crimes. Both Juneau and Anchorage have municipal prosecutor's offices to do those things. And we don't actually investigate most of the criminal conduct. About 99% of the investigations actually occurs by law enforcement throughout the state, and they simply refer the cases to us.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you for being here today, Mr. Skidmore. Can you explain what compassionate prosecution means? Please.
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, yes. Compassionate prosecution of cases means that as we look at our cases and we evaluate what is there, we understand that folks are involved in criminal cases and can be brought to our attention in a whole host of circumstances, both victims and defendants. Sometimes you can actually have very good people who simply make mistakes, even though those mistakes are criminal. It doesn't mean that they have to have the book thrown at them, but it's really a description of how we within the department are committed to look at each and every case individually and try to determine what is best for the people that are involved in that particular case.
Thank you. That's helpful.
The next slide we have is really an overview of the Criminal Division. It gives you a map of the state of Alaska, describes that we have the 9 district attorney's offices throughout the state with an additional 4 satellite offices. What I mean by that is that those 4 offices are actually supervised by one of the other 9 district attorney's offices. We also have the Criminal Appeals Unit, as well as Special Prosecutions. And then you have the Central Office, which is where all of the management resides. The rest of the slide really just gives you a sense of who's in those positions. Both appeals and special prosecutions are color-coded in the dark blue to indicate that they have the statewide jurisdiction. And then you have each of the district attorney's offices in a different color, which corresponds to where they are on the map and the color that we highlight on the map. The most significant thing that I would want to highlight on this slide is that, again, much like for the senior management team of the department, there have been some changes here as well. For instance, if you start in Bethel, the Bethel district attorney used to be Tom Hoffer. He's now moved to Palmer. He moved to Palmer because the DA in that position, Roman Kalachek, has retired. Anchorage, Kenai, Kodiak, Juneau, of course, we still depict Miss Kemp there. We have not yet named a replacement for her, so she's actually doing double duty as both the director and the DA for Juneau at the moment. And then the last one is Ketchikan, who we did have a replacement there. The previous DA was Tim McGillicuddy. Tim has moved on to other things, decided he needed to take a break from work for a while. We are hopeful that Mr. McGillicuddy will return to us in a year or two once he's had his break from the action, as it were. But for the moment, he's been replaced with Christian Pickerel. Again, what I really hope to illustrate through this is that though we have these positions filled and we have good people there, it illustrates the ongoing issues with recruitment and retention for the department. If we move to the next slide, and I believe this gets to some of what Representative Edgman was just asking me a moment ago about the positions that we had 10 new prosecutor positions that were designed to focus on sexual assaults. We have filled 8 of those positions, the ones in Bethel, 2 in Anchorage, Palmer, Kenai, Juneau, and 1 of 2 positions in special prosecutions in Fairbanks. I will tell you that in filling those positions, predominantly what we saw occur is that we had individuals from within the department who elected to slide into one of these new positions because there was a lower caseload associated with them. They were designed to focus on some of the most serious and complex cases. That is a priority for the department, and we need people with experience to do that type of work. Many of those, not all, but many of those positions were filled by individuals within the department who moved into those positions, but of course leaves us in a position of having to recruit to fill the positions they just vacated. The paralegal positions and the law office assistant positions, those 9 positions were all filled with individuals from outside, so that was a very positive thing for us in terms of recruitment and retention. And then to take the next step in that analysis, again, I believe what goes to some of what I think Representative Edgman was asking about a moment ago, was that if you look at the department overall, in the criminal division, a snapshot for us, we have 22 prosecutor positions that are currently empty. I mean, there is not a physical person in the seat. 22 positions. If you look down below, you'll note that the positions in active recruitment indicate that it's 11. The difference between those two is that we have found ourselves in the past year having to engage in hiring practices that we did not previously use. What I mean by that is that we have extended offers on 11 of those 22 positions that have in fact been accepted. They are filled. We're not still recruiting for them. The unfortunate thing is that we have had to match what folks in civil practice do, where they extend offers to third-year law schools. They extend offers to clerks in judicial clerkships long before that other position or obligation of theirs has ended. So we know these people are coming in the future, but that's most of them between June and August. But between now and August, those positions will remain vacant, and that work still has to be managed by the rest of the prosecutors that are currently on staff.
Representative Edgman?
So we heard yesterday from Public Safety that there's a $20,000 bonus, $10,000 for completing the academy, I think it was, and then an additional $10,000 upon becoming a full-time state trooper. But is that a similar approach that is being taken here in terms of getting these 11 attorneys to, you know, sort of obligate themselves in the future to come aboard the department?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the answer is no. We do not have sign-on bonuses. We do not have other things to offer folks in that regard. I can tell you that in the assessments we've done last year, you all may recall, we did a capital appropriation that you all provided to us. Part of that capital appropriation was to look at recruitment and retention. And as we've done that, we brought in an outside firm to help us evaluate this. They did interviews with individuals that were currently in the department, as well as those folks that have left the department in the last several years. And there were several things that they identified that were issues for us. Amongst those things, they wanted to have additional promotional opportunities. They wanted to have a various number of things. I'm not remembering all 5 off the top of my head, but I think to the point that you're asking about, one of those 5 issues identified was pay.
And just to wrap things up, Mr. Co-Chairman, I'm going to bring this issue up regularly because I'm seeing it agency to agency, and we're having great difficulty. You know, we're going to have the court system up here next in terms of meeting our workforce demands. And it just seems to, and it could be a number of issues. I'm not trying to put my finger on 1 or 2 issues, but it just seems to be very different than just a few years ago, or even more pronounced today. And I think it's going to be one of those sleeper public policy issues that Alaska is going to have to come to grips with. Otherwise, it's not just going to be the $20 an hour, we desperately need you to come into Walmart and work. It's going to be key positions around the state that are unfilled, and not 118 vacancies with equipment operators and DOT like we saw a few days ago. It's going to be positions in the criminal justice system or education or, I think a very big looming issue, and I just wanted to continue to emphasize that point, so thank you.
I can tell you that in FY21, we actually extended 34 offers for positions as attorneys. Of those 34 offers, we actually had 8 of them decline because they told us there wasn't enough pay that was available to them. I can tell you that we had 2 of the individuals that we extended offers to that started, and within 2 months, they resigned. One was located in Anchorage, another was located in Kenai. We had another 3 where we had extended offers that unfortunately they had problems with admission to the bar. These are all indicative of the types of problems that we've had. For FY22 to date, we've already done 26 offers, and we're not all the way through FY22. So there is a continual effort on our part to be recruiting and bringing folks in, but we definitely have challenges. We did quite an extensive presentation during the subcommittee where we talked about some of these issues, and we found that we have a larger vacancy rate now than we've had really in the last decade or more in terms of trying to fill positions. We also found that approximately half of our positions have less than 5 years of experience. So I share that data and information for you all as a policy body, and I recognize you all have things that you look at all across the board, but to the extent that that's of assistance to you, I share that information.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you again, Mr. Co-Chair. Has there been any analysis done on, compensation for a state attorney versus someone in the private sector?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, the answer is yes. We have found that there is a substantial difference between the private sector and attorneys within the Department of Law. I believe the numbers were somewhere around a 30% difference in terms of pay in private sector and public sector. That's to be expected. But our challenge really is in that comparison between public sector and public sector. We find that we have attorneys that leave us to go to the U.S. Attorney's Office, also another public agency. We find that we have attorneys that leave us to go to other state agencies in other states. I can't tell you definitively that why that always happens, and I can't give you a comparison of pay ranges, but I certainly know pay is one of the things that we do hear about in those discussions. So if I come back here to slide number 9, the other things that I wanted to highlight is we have 2 victim paralegal vacant positions currently. Those are both in active recruitment right now, and we have 7 staff positions that are currently vacant. 4 are in active recruitment. The other 3 we are in the process of reclassifying, updating position descriptions, that sort of thing, and we hope to be recruiting for them soon. The right half of the slide really deals with the civil division. And for that one, you'll note that they have 15 attorney positions that are currently vacant, and they actually have 18 that they were recruiting right now. And the reason for that is that on this slide, it indicated that there were 3 attorney positions that they know will be vacated in the future, and they've been able to be proactive enough to start those recruitments right now. And I apologize, I got updated numbers for this just yesterday, and I forgot to write them down and bring them with me. So I know we've updated it since we prepared the slide for the subcommittee. But just to give you a sense, both the civil and the criminal division continue to have those sorts of challenges. And this is really the point at which I hand off the presentation to Deputy Attorney Mills.
And Ms. Mills, if you can put yourself on the record.
Thank you. Yes, Corey Mills, Deputy Attorney General for the Civil Division at the Department of Law. It's nice to be here today. Just to follow up on what Deputy Attorney General Skidmore was talking about, on the Civil Division, it is now 20 attorneys that are being recruited for. In the past week, we found 2 more. So we have 5 attorneys that we know are leaving within the next 3 months. So we are actively trying to recruit so we have some cross-training available before they leave. We will see how successful we are. And I will also note that I think if you look at these vacancies, it literally runs pretty much every single one of our sections. So it's across the board, our child protection, transportation, pretty much everyone is trying to recruit for at least one or two attorneys. And I would also note that I think the civil division has experienced, you know, the same reasons that Mr. Skidmore said are the same reasons we're going through. We looked back over the last, you know, since 2018, we had 19% retirement. So that was big turnover. And then we had about 10% move out of state, 10% transfer to another agency, 10% transferred to the private sector, and then another 10% transferred to federal jobs. So that's kind of when we were able to kind of parse through our data, that's kind of what we're seeing. But now I'm going to move to looking at the civil division. Our core services on the civil side, we kind of group them in four categories. One is safety and financial well-being of Alaskans, fostering conditions for responsible development of our natural resources, tying back to our constitutional mandates when it comes to natural resources, protecting the fiscal integrity of the state, and the bucket I call promoting good governance, which is really think of your, you know, labor law, your employment, your elections, all of that sort of work falls within good governance.
And I've got a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The question could be for either testifying right now. In the sense of having to fill new positions, and when if we go back and look historically, are we also trying to provide for more services or for more people than, let's say, 10 years ago? In other words, is the Department of Law bigger in man size, significantly bigger in man size than it was 10 years ago, or has it been relatively flat?
So through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I'll start and hand it off to Deputy Attorney General Skidmore for his view of things on the criminal side. The civil side has had a 36% reduction in our budget since, I think that was, if you go back to either 14 or 15, as I recall. And that doesn't count the multi-year that I'm gonna talk about. But we've never had to let go of people, but we have had to not fill positions, basically, or get rid of some of our positions as attrition, natural attrition happens. So we do have less attorneys, and I would say doing the same workload that was required before those reductions, if that's helpful.
And this is John Skidmore for the Criminal Division, through the chair to Representative Ortiz. I would tell you that I haven't looked at the most recent population statistics, but I would suspect that we saw our population increase over the last decade. I think it's fallen off a little bit in the last several years, but not such that it's back at the level that it was a decade ago. And for the Criminal Division, we had a similar scenario in which we had a significant downsizing for a number of years, but then I would say in the last 3 to 4 years, we have successfully returned the resources in the Criminal Division to where we were before. I think we've gone a little bit beyond that, but I would also tell you that the workload that we have compared to 10 years ago is larger.
Okay, thank you for that, I appreciate it.
So we are now on slide 11, and for the record, again, this is Corey Mills. So now you're seeing the breakdown of those areas that I talked about that the Civil Division focuses on, and these are kind of our areas of practice, how our attorneys are grouped within the department. So when it comes to protecting Alaskans, that looks like commercial and fair business. That's your licensing, occupational licensing folks. They help all the boards that do the occupational licensing. They help the Department of Commerce in some other ways. But it's mostly alcohol and beverage control board, you know, your chiropractors, everything you could think of that has a licensing aspect. Human services, they basically advise the Department of Health and Social Services except for the child protection, which is also on here. Child protection is our largest section. We actually have, I think, 26 attorneys in there. And on the recruitment and retention, our child protection section, 18 of those attorneys have less than 5 years of experience at this point. So we are really in a rebuild mode, I would say, in most of our sections. opinions, appeals, and ethics. They often do, their largest workload is child protection appeals. So our child protection section handles the trial level, and then the opinions, appeals, and ethics does the appeals for the child protection matters. They also do all of our other major appeals, but their largest workload, I would say, is the child protection appeals. And those have only been increasing over the years. Those last year we saw a little bit of a dip, mostly because you didn't have as many children around mandatory reporters. So your references went down, the number of referrals. But we expect that number to go back up and to kind of get back to FY20 numbers and FY19 numbers. So promoting good governance, like I said, this is your employment law, labor and state affairs. Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is also kind of grouped in there. The Department of Labor, kind of your core government type related services. Legislation and regulations, that's not legislation for the legislature, that's legislation for the governor. And then our department also has a role in reviewing all bills that pass the legislature and advise the governor on any legal issues with those. And we also have a unique role in our regulations where our chief regulations attorney actually reviews regulations before they come over for filing and can disapprove them if there's some sort of conflict with state law. Information and project support sounds very techie, and that's exactly what they are. There are public records, we're now moving into e-discovery, for example, so they handle all of our databases, all of our timekeeping, how to keep our matters. We're trying to move much more online, and they handle all of that along with databases and data privacy for the state from a security perspective. Public corporations and government services. So this is the section that advises, you know, the Alaska Industrial Development and Alaska Housing Finance Corp. and just all the myriad of public corps we have. They're very commercial and contractual in nature. And then we've got protecting fiscal integrity and fostering economic development. I think most of these are straightforward. Natural resources is the Department of Natural Resources. Oil and gas is both revenue and natural resources. Environmental is the section that advises DEC. Transportation, and then torts and workers' compensation is our group that kind of defends the state against those actions. Up at the top, regulatory affairs and public advocacy, the Attorney General's Office has a unique role before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, where we advocate on behalf of the public to make sure that utility rates are fair and reasonable. And so we have a section that does a lot of that. It is very technical work, so we also have some analysts that are really important to that. Our special litigation section, it doesn't show on here, but half of that section does our consumer protection work. So they're the ones that go out and make sure that businesses are acting fairly, and also takes part in a lot of the multi-state consumer protection and antitrust actions that occur.
Representative Josephson?
Chair, Deputy AG Mills, before you turn to page 12, on the workers' comp section, can you share with the committee what I think I heard about the dearth of state AAGs and the need to contract?
Yes, thank you, Representative Josephson. Through the chair, we've been having a lot of discussion about a lot of these topics in our subcommittee. Our workers' compensation section, we have never had to procure outside counsel to assist with that work. But we were so low on number of attorneys, as well as basically every workers' compensation attorney we have is fairly new to that work, as well as to the practice of law. And so we have actually had to get outside counsel because we had about 270 cases that we couldn't assign because we just didn't have anyone to do them. I'm happy to report that we have successfully hired one attorney for our workers' compensation work. I believe there is one more opening left to fill. So when it comes to the Department of Law's budget, I just want to remind everyone that even though we do all of that great work for all of the departments, in a lot of cases, those departments are paying for the work. So it's their budgets that matter for that work. In terms of the Department of Law's budget, I would put the three, kind of divided up into three buckets in terms of the work that is paid for through our budget appropriations. The first and one of the largest is child protection. Like I said, that's our biggest section in the department, as well as the appeals. You have that good governance, that core employment, you know, elections, advising the governor, the lieutenant governor. And then you have statehood rights, or another, we've also called this state's rights, statehood defense, as well as revenue protection. So in terms of our increment request for this year, it's another multi-year appropriation, and it really falls within that third bucket, that statehood rights or statehood defense. So the multi-year appropriation, as you may recall, last year, the legislature graciously provided $4 million in a multi-year appropriation for FY 22 through FY 25, fiscal year 25, a $4 million that essentially mirrors this language. So when we were coming up with the $4 million request last year, we were just at the kind of very beginning of looking at the increase in this type of work. And we established that we thought $4 million was a good start, but as we started to evaluate once the fiscal year ended and we really were seeing what cases are we getting, what can we anticipate, I actually kind of went down and really did a deep dive, creating a list, trying to figure out what existing sources of funding we have, what are our historical sources of funding, and where do we think we could end up by fiscal year 25 with the existing litigation we have, as well as the anticipated litigation coming down the pike. And what, after looking at that, what I determined is that $4 million is very unlikely to get us there, and that an additional $4 million, if we have $8 million, I think this group of additional work that seems to be coming, the workload that's coming, can be handled. And a four-year time horizon, in this case, it goes to fiscal year 25, so this would be a three-year. Last year's was a four-year. But you think about litigation generally within 4 years, you can finish that litigation. So 2 to 4 years is about how long it takes.
I'm sorry, Ms. Mills, so statehood defense is not an issue that's a new one. It's something that the state has always had to push back on. But to my recollection, the line item statehood defense and the appropriation for it is new. Under what line item did that appear in prior years? Like, where would the funds come to fund statehood defense activities?
So, Chair Foster, that's an excellent question, and that usually came through our natural resources. If you look at our allocations, natural resources, one of the lines, and it generally was captured within there. And what this is meant to do is kind of get us over a hump we're seeing. Get us, and by having it be a multi-year, that means it ends, it lapses, and we can kind of get back to business. But right now, we're not planning on building up our personnel, for example, within the department, but rather trying to rely on outside counsel, making sure we can pay for the consultants, and get through this increase in work that's kind of compounded over time, as you've had rules continually change, and there's been different challenges at different stages, and we're now layering litigation on top of litigation but never reaching a final resolution. And so what we're hoping is that we can get to that final resolution, have clarity from the courts, so that you kind of reset the table. And I mean the hope is that then we'd be able to kind of go back down and manage it more internally.
Okay, thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Deputy AG Mills, although there are outstanding invoices, I assume. Didn't the subcommittee learn that so far you've only paid $260,000 on the current fiscal multi-appropriations $4 million? So this, was I right about that?
So through the chair, Rep. Josephson, that is correct. I think to date we've spent, I actually have the more exact number, I think it's $267,000, although I haven't taken into account January yet because we haven't finalized those. But I do anticipate that by the end of the year, that number will go up to probably more like $1 million or more. And we're just starting a lot of this litigation. And of course, the beginning stages are going to be less, and as time goes on, you're going to compound those cases more. So I anticipate that going up by quite a bit shortly. And I guess to highlight that, you know, I don't know if you're all familiar with this. Department of Law puts this out every year. We're required by statute. It's our Federal Laws and Litigation Report. So last year, this report at the same time had 35 matters on it. This year, it has 47 matters. So you can see that cases that have been going on for years still aren't done, and then we're starting new cases and seeing new issues arising. So that's really what, in our mind, justifies this request. So I just want to go over real quick kind of our general strategy so you understand how we're determining what sources of funding we're using to pay for what. So we feel like our core service at Department of Law using our personnel is to really what we call defend statehood, but that's, you know, making sure our lines of revenue, the oil and gas money, the royalties that come in to fill the permanent fund, that those are protected. And to make sure the laws that apply to Alaska, I mean, think the Sturgeon case with the Alaska National Interest Lands Act, that those are our core functions, and we're gonna focus on that first with our resources. The next thing we can do is when it comes to some of these national issues, there are other states out there that experience the same issues we do. So let's partner with them, let them take the lead on some of these issues, and that saves resources for the state while still making sure Alaska's interest is represented. And then the last option, and one we've had to go to, is outsourcing. So this is our outside counsel to take on some of these matters when we just don't have the resources. They may be more Alaska specific, so we can't really partner with other states. Alaska is a very unique state in terms of our relationship with the federal government, as well as our just the laws that apply to us are unique. And for example, with the Clean Water Act, you know, we have more wetlands in our state than all of the lower 48 combined. So when you think about the impacts to our state of whatever rules define waters of the United States, those issues impact Alaska in a very unique way. And so having our own representation and making sure Alaska's interests are represented is important. So next I'm gonna go to how are we currently using this multi-year appropriation funding? And what we've kind of done is looked at cases. So like I said, to Rep. Merrick's question and Rep. Foster's, we have certain historical sources of funding under our natural resources line item in the budget, as well as our environmental in certain cases. And so we want to keep using those funding sources. You know, those are our kind of the bread and butter of what we normally do. And so what we looked at is what cases need to be funded in this multi-year appropriation because it doesn't really fit, or we're going to use outside counsel and we just don't have the resources. So that's what's primarily being funded. So those cases go to the multi-year appropriation first for their costs. And we've got four on there right now. The majority, like the two in the middle, are multi-state cases. So we aren't bearing the majority of those costs. So they're not gonna be huge cost drivers. The last one, the 40-mile river, that case is already at two, I mean, that takes up 200,000 of the 267,000. And we anticipate by the end of the year, that's probably gonna double or more, just because these types of cases are so evidence intensive. I think we're, by the time we're all done, we'll have done 18 depositions in that case. And there's just a lot of historical evidence. The first item, the ANCSA 17D1 revocation delays, this is the withdrawal of the public land orders. So with the withdrawal of the 28 million acres for state selection or selection by Native corporations or selection by Native veterans for Native allotments. This was the withdrawal of those public land orders that didn't let any of those entities then choose those lands. So that's ongoing as it stands. And then the secondarily funded by the multi-year appropriation. So these are cases where we have an existing funding source, but we're not sure it'll get us through a year. So it, you know, these are annual appropriations that come in. So in a given year, we may have costs that are much higher than the annual appropriation we get. And so we're using the multi-year appropriation as a kind of secondary funding source for those cases. Again, we've contracted with two outside counsel firms, Davis, Graham, and Stubbs, as well as Fenimore Craig. Those happened recently. The procurement process can take a bit to get things like that in place. And those will be kind of our main go-tos for outside counsel for the overflow in these natural resource cases. And then we've also hired, and I'll go to the next slide for this, we've also hired Kelly Dry, another outside counsel firm, to do the second item on this list, which is the federal contaminated sites. And that's just an area of expertise. We have some contaminated sites experience, but these were sites that were federally, that were contaminated sites when they were under federal ownership, and then they were transferred to Alaska Native corporations as well as the state, and they still haven't been cleaned up. And so we have some anticipated action in this area that's being led by the Department of Environmental Conservation that could lead to litigation. That's our third forum.
Before we get too far away from slide 15, we've got a question. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Ms. Mills, I'm trying to get a kind of a handle on some of your use of your terms. You're talking about cases or issues that are primarily funded by MYA and then secondarily funded by MYA. What, in the cases of secondarily funded by MYA, let's just say Ambler Road challenges, what would be the primary source of funding for the Amber Road challenges versus the secondarily MYA funds?
So through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that's an excellent question, and I apologize that I wasn't clear. So if you go to our budget and you look in, there's an allocation for natural resources, and that covers, you know, a myriad, our work for the department, but it also covers actions like this where we're protecting, for example, mining royalties that come into the state and get put into the permanent fund, or revenues, or access issues. So we have some existing money that may come in from a department. So we have our allocation with general fund that we get in our budget under that natural resources item. And then we also may have, for example, a department that is paying us a certain amount for work that our attorneys do or that outside counsel does in certain areas. The secondarily funded simply means that we're not going to the multi-year appropriation first. We're trying to use our existing sources of money to make sure we can only go to the multi-year appropriation when we absolutely need to. We're trying to be good stewards of that resource. So if by the, you know, if we run out of the existing source, whether it's interagency receipts from Department of Natural Resources, whether it's you know, our natural resources budget for the Department of Law, whether it's money we get to protect the royalties that come into the state and come into the permanent fund, you know, if we run out of that source of funding, then
stop with that one, if you would. Money that we get to protect royalties. Explain that one, if you would.
Yes, so the department does receive certain permanent fund receipts that comes to us in order to protect or take actions relating to royalties. Those can be anywhere from your typical oil and gas matters. You know, that's where it mostly comes up when you're fighting over the amount of royalties, but it can also be actions, for example, before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, where two private parties are fighting over tariffs, but that then impacts royalties. So it's a way to ensure that we have resources to protect the royalties and get the most out of our royalties that go into the permanent fund.
Okay, so if I can follow up, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Oh,
so, and again, excuse my ignorance here, I'm just trying to learn as we're going through this presentation. So is it correct to say that these appropriations, or these sources of funding, I should say, ultimately they come from state resources, whether they're agency resources or permanent fund corporation resources? We're not talking about any other resources other than state resources in almost all of these cases. Is that correct?
So through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that's absolutely correct. These are all just different funding sources within the state that the department uses for our legal services.
Okay, and then perhaps it's a little bit early for this question, but because I'm in the queue, when we take a look at total resources that are available on average from year to year to year, what percentage does the last appropriation of $4 million and the hoped-for appropriation of another $4 million increase the total fund amount that Department of Law is used to having?
So through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I do not have those numbers in front of me because I would have to take kind of the reimbursable services money we get, plus the general fund money we get, plus kind of the permanent fund related royalties. But I believe, is Amber LeBlanc online? Because she may have those budget numbers.
Ms. LeBlanc, are you there?
Hello, yes, this is Amber LeBlanc, the Administrative Services Director for Department of Law. I have the numbers, but it would take me a while to get all of it together from the different funding sources. So I would request to answer that with a follow-up email.
That sounds fine. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the liberty.
Thank you. And in the queue, I've got Representative LeBlanc and Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This the state under the statehood defense topic. Does the state have a litigation partnership with Voice of the Arctic Organization? And if so, how is that partnership proceeding? And I recall from last year's capital budget, $1 million grant was offered to that organization. Is that correct?
So through the chair, Representative LeBlanc, I only know of that appropriation through the news, so I'll defer to someone else on that. But in terms of our work with Voice of the Arctic, the Department of Law has no connection and has not been working with the Voice of the Arctic on these legal matters. We have been working with some of the members, some of the villages and other things that have similar interests to the state that may be aligned in litigation, but not through that organization.
And if I could, as a follow-up, do you have a report available to our offices that summarize any litigation partnerships and any status updates, if you will? Because I know that it's a detailed world as far as legal actions, and if there's any material that you could share with our offices, I know I would appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Deputy Attorney General Mills, we had an interesting conversation yesterday or the day before maybe about the multi-year appropriation. And looking at the list here, and I'll just pick four, for example, the administration joined in a case, a Missouri case on greenhouse gas emissions, and I'm confident it didn't take the position of the most mitigation to deal with greenhouse gas issues. On Ambler Road challenges, it takes the position in favor, presumably, of Ada and the miners and not villagers in Otna and Allakaket and in that Koyukuk area into the west. On Pebble Mine, I'm confident because I've read about this. I think about 60% of the Alaskan people don't want the mine. Now, there are obviously narrower issues that have nothing to do with the mine. I get that. But nonetheless, broadly speaking, this is not supportive, I think, of the majority of Alaskans' position. And then finally, on the next page on the Tongass National Forest, it may have been supportive of Southeast Alaska in the 90s or before, but my sense and my reading is that Southeast views itself differently than it did decades ago. So my question is, I understand, because of my work on issues involving public employees unions, that the AG's office is a unique office to the governor. It is not just another appendage, it's sort of a vital organ to the governor. I get that. But you're here asking for an appropriation because we're the appropriators. So that's an acknowledgement of that. And I guess what I'm wondering is, just looking at those four cases, for example, what is your view of the legislature's role in saying this isn't necessarily representative of Alaskans?
So through the chair, Representative Josephson, you know, the power of appropriation lies with the legislature. So that is a power you have. In terms of the policies, you know, I guess I'd point out two things. One, and I think Chair Foster pointed this out earlier, we have, most of these cases are similar to cases we have been fighting for years or in for years. So a change in administration, a change in legislature hasn't really changed those priorities very much. Sometimes there's more of a focus in a certain area versus another area, but on the whole, most administrations, and I would argue most Alaskans, still believe that when it comes to, you know, states' rights, state land, state management, that Alaska knows better when it comes to those things. And so that's just a theme I've seen since I've been in the department, no matter what administration I've been in. So that's one point. But again, you always have the power of appropriation. But my second point, and I know we had this discussion in subcommittee as well, is these cases to me are not about whether you like polar bears or don't like polar bears. It's about who should manage. Who should manage the wildlife? Who should manage the fish and game resources? You know, what rules do people have to look to when they're doing development? Do they have to look to, you know, 10 federal rules plus 5 state rules? Or can we get it down to 5 state rules that still protect the environment and responsibly develop our resources? The only other element I would call to is the legislature also has an obligation, just as the governor does, just as I think the Department of Law does, to Article 8 of the Alaska Constitution, which is very unique among the states, and actually talks about sustained yield principles and responsible resource development and developing our resources for the maximum benefit of the people. And so I think that is an element that you have to take into account when you're looking at your appropriation authority, in terms of making sure we're adhering to that. But I think there's a lot of latitude in there. I'm not saying this appropriation allies with that, but I think when you're looking at the cases we're bringing, it's about that management struggle, and to make sure we can have an economically prosperous state, which is balancing the protection of our resources along with the development of those resources.
Okay. And please continue.
So I just wanted to come to the second, slide 16. So I talked, so let me just go back real quick. These are the matters that we are already under litigation. You can find them in our chart, and I'm happy to provide this to the committee, to Rep. LeBond's request, that really shows every single matter we're working on. Again, the multi-year appropriation will only cover a fraction of those. But the next slide is the matters that we're actively monitoring, stuff we're anticipating coming down the pike in the next year to 2 years that will add to this need for resources. The BLM, this is the Bureau of Land Management Resource Management Plans. There's a number of resource management plans that are going through the process. You know, the state actively monitors those, comments on those. So we're not sure where those are going to go yet. Federally contaminated sites, like I said, these are sites that were federally owned, transferred to the state or a native corporation, but never cleaned up. And so what the state is currently doing is trying to get the federal government to do the cleanup that they should have done 50 years ago. And so that one is actively in process. A notice of intent was filed on, I think, 500 different sites, contaminated sites. And so we're, you know, that 60-day notice will be up here shortly, if not today, potentially. I'm trying to remember the exact date. But that's something that's being actively monitored and discussed for what other legal action steps we should take. Navigable waterways, again, this is a kind of perennial one, but we do have, in addition to the 40 mile, we have the Koyukuk that we have already filed on, and we have two other rivers that we're looking at. And if you've ever seen the map, you know, these are issues of the state has determined, you know, how many rivers that we think fall under state management, and the federal government is refusing on 70 to 80% of them to recognize state ownership. So this is about the state being able to say, no, we manage this, our rules apply. RS-2477, revised statute 2477, these are public access right-of-ways. I believe there's one kind of in progress right now that's being looked at. This is another very, these two, the navigable waterways and RS-2477s, are very evidence intense. So in terms of financial resources, these take quite a bit, and I'll get to that on my next slide. And the Tongass National Forest, Tongass National Forest, we already kind of touched on. And then secondarily funded, we have some Endangered Species Act decisions that we're monitoring, as well as the Clean Water Act, really around the definition of the waters of the United States. Go ahead.
If I could ask about the RS-2477. On slide 16, I see you've got the Chicken Trail RS-2477, and then on slide 16, you've got it kind of in general, and so I assume that's the one you're referring to. That's the one that you're working on right now. Anytime I've ever asked about this, my question has been, so for example, north of Nome, you've got Serpentine Hot Springs. You've got public access all the way up to Taylor, an old mine. But then from Taylor to get to the Serpentine Hot Springs, which is very popular and people would love to go there, and National Park Service has got great brochures on, come visit this. We've got, it looks very prehistoric. It looks like Jurassic Park. And in my mind, you know, there are just so many people who would love to go, and this could be this great tourist opportunity. But the last 6 miles or so, it's over Bering Landbridge National. It's in a park. But there's a trail that goes to there. It's not something that's a new site. It's, you know, an old tractor trail that goes there. So it would, to me, it could be an RS-2477. And so anytime I've asked about this, and I'll say, what would it take? The answer is always, well, it's on a case-by-case basis. So while you might be able to get, you know, the feds to say, well, the Chicken Trail, okay, we're going to give in on that one, but there's got to be like 500 trails in the state, yeah. And you've got to fight every single one. And you mentioned it's evidence-based, and I just wish that there would be a day where, you know, the feds said, okay, we're going to recognize that old, you know, tractor trails, mining trails, you know, subsistence trails, whatever it might be. You know, we're going to recognize that those are allowed by the public as long as they stay on that trail. And in terms of evidence, I mean, when you fly over it, you can see the trail. To me, that seems like pretty good evidence. Is that also your reply, I guess, in terms of when we fight these, it's got to be a case-by-case basis? If you could just comment on that, I guess.
Yeah, Chair Foster, unfortunately, that is the case. There are, I mean, these date back to, yes, you can see the trail today, but could you see it in aerial photographs in the 1930s? Or back to the, you know, there's a certain date at which they cut off. So you have to, and I cannot remember that date right now, but you have to go all the way back to that time and show that there was historic use, show where it was. We also have trouble getting them to recognize the actual use and what's the scope and the use. And I think we're really hoping, I think that's one of the things we're trying to find is what is that good case to create those good factors in case law so that we could have discussions and negotiations and settle a lot of these. But we need to start by getting that precedent because we're not getting the federal government to really sit down with us. And you know, whether that'll be successful, I don't know. I will tell you on the chicken litigation, I think we're in settlement right now. So that one we're actually hoping to wrap up. I don't anticipate a lot more costs, but I know that the Department of Natural Resources is actively looking at different cases and what would be a good, efficient use of resources to try to set that precedent.
And I don't want to spend too much time on this one. I'll just ask one more final, and that is, you mentioned there's like a cutoff date. You know, you have to go back to maybe the 1930s or something, and I don't. Is ANCSA about the time when anything prior to that, because I know like USGS maps, you know, those are, a lot of these are from the 1940s and the 1950s, and they've got the trail. It's not a picture, an aerial picture, but it's the federal government's own map that shows a trail there. And that's a lot of the trails that are on the Seward Peninsula, they're right on there, and I would think that would suffice. And anyway, this is probably also a private conversation that we can have, and I don't want to get too much into it.
Chair Foster, I mean, I think those are all elements, and then you have to ask, was any land withdrawn at any point? What's the title? You have to go back through. Anyway, it's a fascinating area, but very complicated, but I'd be happy to have a private meeting on it.
Great. Thank you, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Mills, on the subject of 2477s, isn't another element that makes it difficult that sometimes these cases pit Alaskans against other Alaskans, like the Putina Lake matter, where the state took a position, lost a motion for summary judgment to my memory, I'm trying to remember the judge's name, and essentially was defending a wider right-of-way, wanting 60 feet versus 100 feet, not recognizing the right to place a toll, all sorts of things that put it in conflict with the Otna Corporation, correct? So sometimes the vigorous assertion of ours 2477s pits us in a battle between Alaskans. That can happen, am I right?
So through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think it's accurate to say that case law surrounding ours 2477s is not just a federal government and state issue. It is definitely one. We've had cases where the state has just been a third party that enters into after two private parties because one wants to keep crossing someone else's land. We've had the Iditarod Trail that we successfully litigated, and then the Klutina Lake is one that's currently before the Supreme Court on reconsideration. They just accepted reconsideration on that issue, and so we'll see where that one ends up. But yes, I would say this is one where it's definitely, you know, all of us care about our backyards and who's walking through it, so it can definitely raise those issues.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. You know, you're asking for a lot of money for statehood defense. How often are these cases successful?
So, Representative Merrick, it's hard to go back. Like we don't track our cases in our database that way, so it's really hard to go back and say. So what I will tell you, for example, on the cases we have right now, is that we just survived a motion to dismiss on the first case. We got a preliminary injunction on the second and the third case. 40 Mile, it's hard to tell, but I can't see how we're not gonna win that case. There's just too much evidence that it's navigable. You know, some of these others are potentially up in the air. We're looking at settling chicken. You know, I don't know where they're going to land. If you look back, I mean, some of these cases are actually us defending the federal government. So it's not always where we're against the federal government. Sometimes it's that the federal government actually granted something that we agree with that will help develop our resources or get to state land, and then a third party challenges. And so we have those cases as well, and then you have more of the deference to the federal agency that might apply you know, so it's, I'd say it's a mixed bag, and really depends on the case. But on the navigable waterways, we've been very successful. We actually got a bad faith motion granted against the feds, where the court found they acted in bad faith on a navigable waterways case. So those types of cases, I would say we have success. Others in the Endangered Species Act, you know, we can win at the district court. I know of two cases where we won at the district court and then didn't win it on appeal. So mixed bag is, I guess, all I can say.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so that I think covers, sorry, let me speak into the microphone. That I think covers the cases we're, and types of cases we're looking at funding. And then I just wanted to show you that we really did kind of dive deep to figure out what is the appropriate amount here. What do we think could cover this so that we, because litigation costs, you know, really ebb and flow. And so you can have a year where the case will be a huge amount of costs, and then the next year, not so much. And so, and we've used multi-year funding for that reason. We used it on the Flint Hills case. We also used it on the BP corrosion case back in the day. So these are what we found to be the typical costs if you use our internal counsel on these types of cases. And basically, if you want to apply outside counsel, you generally double it. So outside counsel for a navigable watersways case would be more like 1.2, 1.3 million. So navigable waters and RS-2477, as I explained before, those are really going to be your most expensive. The next types of cases are the most typical. They're APA stands for Administrative Procedure Act cases, basically. So you're just looking at the record. You're not looking at evidence. So those are going to be a lot cheaper, ultimately, than the other types of cases. So you've got, you know, $150,000 for the district court on those cases, and then a $50,000 appeal. Again, just double those for the if we have to use outside counsel, which we are anticipating needing to use because our internal resources won't be sufficient. So these are the numbers we kind of took to look at what are we anticipating, what is it going to cost, what are our existing sources of funding, and that's how we came to having a total of $8 million we think would get us through this kind of additional hump of 13 to 14 more cases than we've historically had to do.
Great, thank you very much. We've got one last question here, and then we better jump right over into the court system. We've only got 45 minutes left in the Finance Committee meeting. We had a lot of good questions, though, so I appreciate your taking the time. So Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. McMills, kind of going back to Representative Merrick's question, because obviously, you know, in all facets of state government, resources are limited. Is there an active analysis that's done by the team there at the Department of Law as to the advisability or the winnability of a case before you proceed towards a particular case or a particular issue? Or is it just if the administration says we're going to go for this, then we just go for it? Is that how it works, or how much consideration is there to the issue of whether the case will really turn out like we'd like it to?
So through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I think that's a great question, and I would say that it's, you know, we are the attorneys, so we advise and we'll make sure we give the best and most candid advice to our clients. I will also say, though, that the factors you look at, yes, are we going to win? The other question is, are we going to win at district court level? Are we going to win on appeal? Or are we going to win at the U.S. Supreme Court? And you'll see that with the Sturgeon case, which ended up costing about over $700,000 just for the state. But we ultimately won that case, even if we lost at every other level. So there's levels you have to take into account. How far are we willing to take this? When do we think it's going to be resolved? So that's one factor. The other factor is, there are times when part of the strategy is this is the state's rights. These are so vital and so important that you have to take a stand. And by taking a stand on this case, even if we don't win it, we may slow them down from doing other things, or we may they may think twice about taking other actions, and that has definitely happened. So I would also say that the factors that you take into account are a myriad of them, but one of them is likelihood of success and at what level we will succeed.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And so with that, any final comments before we switch on over here?
No, thank you.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for coming in and giving us some great information. So with that, we will now move over to the Alaska court system. And today we have Deputy Administrative Director Doug Wolver. And so we'll switch over our slide deck here. Just take a quick moment for those of you on the phone. In the future, if we've got time with the Finance Committee between presentations, we'll from time to time take a 5-minute little break just so folks can stretch their legs, but we better not do that today. But we've got Mr. Wolver here, if you can put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Doug Wolver, Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska Court System. I'll start off kind of like the Department of Law did with our mission. Our mission, we're here to resolve cases, and we're here to resolve them in ways that are consistent with the law, with integrity. We try to do these promptly, but all in be impartial, but all of those things are stressed, or at least some of those points are stressed in times like we're in now, particularly resolving cases promptly. As you know, we've had to, along with all the other courts in the country, including the federal courts, have to suspend our jury trials. That means there will be delays that would not otherwise be there. Nevertheless, our mission statement really is how we kind of assess all of the decisions we make and whether or not those decisions are consistent with that mission. There are a couple of things that make Alaska's court system different than most. One, we're a unified court system. There is only the Alaska court system here and the federal courts, of course. We don't have county courts, we don't have municipal courts. We're a unified judiciary. I would also add that so is the Department of Law unified, with the exception of the two municipal prosecuting offices. The Department of Corrections is unified. That makes it easier for all of you to set state policy because it's all at the state level. And it makes it much easier for all of us within the judicial system, including the prosecutors and the defense attorneys and everybody else to work together because we are all a unified system. So there are a lot of benefits to having that. And different things affect how busy we are. Yeah. And some of those are obvious, like population. You'll be seeing, I'm sure, before very long, a bill before the legislature to increase, for example, the number of judges in Palmer. They're now the busiest court in Alaska because their population, as you all know, has risen substantially over the last number of years. But there are other things, too. Suppose, Municipality of Anchorage were to get a grant for more police officers. That can increase the number of arrests. That can affect the workload. The economy, just in general terms, people who have good jobs tend to create less trouble than people who are unemployed. So the economy has a big factor. And, of course, statutory changes. Some statutes have a small impact. Some statutory changes have a big impact. And, of course, we're learning that things like pandemics can have a significant impact on our operations. Mostly the court system is made up of clerical employees, but we do have about 112 judicial officers, including all of our magistrates. And they are, we have Superior Court judges in 15 different communities. We have District Court judges in 7 different communities. And we have 9 Appellate Court judges. And currently they're in 2 communities, Anchorage and Fairbanks. But we have had, as you well know, have had a justice here in Juneau as well in the past. This is kind of a picture of where we are around the state. These are our 4 judicial districts, 2nd Judicial District in northwestern Alaska, the 4th through the central part of the state, 3rd District, south central, and 1st District down here. And it's kind of interesting, there are 4 districts, but the number of employees we have spread out amongst those four districts varies dramatically. So we have, for example, 34 full-time and part-time inclusive employees in the entire second judicial district, which is much bigger than almost every state. And we have 34 employees. And in the third judicial district, we have almost 400. So different resources, different communities, different issues, different concerns in all of those different locations.
Thank you, Mr. Williver. I had a question. What determines which judicial district a case is tried?
The location of the event, of the crime.
Where now, the crime was,
yes,
committed?
In criminal cases. In civil cases, there's a lot more discretion about where you could bring the case. But in a criminal case, it will be in the district where the crime occurred.
Okay, thank you.
And here's our funding source, our all sources. This just shows, I've used this little diagram a number of times over the years, it just shows that something you already know, state government is mostly the executive branch for very good reasons. And the judicial branch and the legislative branch are relatively small slices of that overall pie. Alaskans serve. This is a slide that we came up with a number of years ago when then House Finance would like to see just kind of how many people do you touch in a year. There are a number of ways to look at that, but this is kind of gives you an idea of how many cases are filed, how many contacts we have through our Family Law Self-Help Center, court system website visits. Now, some of that is a little bit exaggerated because we all in court, almost all of us have the court system's web pages, our homepage, so every time we log in, we get another hit there. Nevertheless, that number used to be much, much lower, and our court website is visited routinely, and of course you can see 1.7 million court view searches. But the pandemic is, of course, the big thing that's going on these days, and we have done what everybody else has done. We have taken the steps that you all have taken. We wear masks in court facilities. We publicly distance, socially distance. We do all kinds of cleaning. We rely an awful lot more on technology. We've always relied on technology more in the state of Alaska for our courts than others. Many courts, even today, don't allow telephonic testimony. Our courts couldn't possibly operate without telephonic testimony, and we do it routinely, and we have since statehood. But now, of course, we're using Zoom and all kinds of other things to assist us with holding court hearings and continuing our operations, even when we're trying to limit the number of people who come into court personally. And it's also important to note that, as the Chief Justice mentioned in his State of Judiciary the other day, We never closed because of COVID. And we never stopped having emergency proceedings. We never stopped child native aid hearings. We never stopped any of those things. We did start using Zoom, of course. You know, everybody, a few years ago, I'd never heard of Zoom. And now, you know, Zoom is everywhere. And even my parents are using Zoom, and they're in their 90s. But Zoom has been an amazing thing. We have selected jurors through Zoom, and presumptive death hearings, which are a trial, but they're not a contested trial. We have a number of those. We have chosen the jury, had the hearing, and deliberated all on Zoom, which I believe we were the first state to have done that. Nevertheless, even though we have been open, trial cases are down, felony filings are down, misdemeanor filings are down, civil cases are down, not by a lot, but by a measurable amount. There you can see the felonies. For years, I've been coming in here saying, yep, this year's another record for felons. This year's another record. This year is the first year in a number of years where we have a slight decrease in our felony filings. Same with misdemeanor filings. We're still above where we were a few years ago, but we are down from the last 3 years. Some of the fiscal impacts of the pandemic, We have lapsed, we will be lapsing some funds this year. We don't yet know exactly how much because the year isn't over. But the lapsed funds comes from the savings that, in part, from the savings we've had with not holding jury trials. We're about $1 million below where our typical jury costs are for the year. I think in FY 17, 18, and 19, we were about $1.3 million a year in jury trial costs. This year, we're about the $0.3, the $350,000 in jury costs. We also received about $3.2 million in CARES funding that allowed us to purchase a bunch of the technology equipment that facilitated remote hearings and facilitated people being able to work from home. And additionally, right now, we are applying for some FEMA money to reimburse us for past expenses. And we were expecting between $75,000 and $100,000. Hoping it's actually quite a bit more than that, closer to $500,000. That money won't come to us, but it will go into the general fund, and it will be for money we've already expended. So it doesn't benefit the court directly, but it does benefit the state's general fund. We are still having cases. As you know, we have been very busy. The Chief Justice mentioned this the other day. We're still resolving tens of thousands of petitions. We have over 125,000 hearings. We have had 112 jury trials last year during a period where we opened up prior to the latest wave hitting. And as of yesterday, as you know, we started jury trials again in the middle of this, or in January. As of yesterday, we'd held 27 criminal jury trials this year so far, and 3 civil trials. So 30 jury trials, which at this point in time in the year is right about or just above average. So the jury trials are back pretty much full time. And we have used, of course, a lot of Zoom time doing those things, and expanded teleconference hearings. Teleconferences, our monthly cost went up from $14,000 a month to $44,000 a month, which is $420,000 a year. But that's allowed things to continue to go. And that's been very, very helpful. And also what we're doing is we're live streaming jury trials and other hearings. And this is something we'll likely continue. It costs some money, but it allows for a lot more public access to what goes on in court hearings.
Mr. Williver, thank you. The trials by Zoom, did you have to make any regulatory changes to allow that?
Madam Co-Chair, no. We could do that under our existing rules. I believe it could have, although I suspect we have one of our orders from the Chief Justice or Supreme Court orders may have specifically allowed that, but we didn't change our court rules to do that. And as I've kind of talked about this already, we are resuming jury trials. There have been some kind of difficulties in that. We had several trials. There's one here in Juneau that was extended 3 times for substantial periods of time because of someone getting COVID, either the attorney or a witness, the defendant. So we have interrupted trials on a number of occasions, although for the most part it's been relatively smooth. And of course we have directly related to COVID, as of course the vacancies related to sick leave, when the schools were closed or were homeschooling, parents having to take leave because they have now children at home. So we, like every other part of not only state government, but every other part of life, have been significantly impacted by people out on leave.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question might be not on the slides, but or part of the slides, but the court system experienced a cyber attack last year, I recall. And could you maybe just give me a minute or two on the outcome of that event, and what have you done to prepare for the next time that happens?
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, yes, we did have a cyber attack last year. We were very fortunate that our IS people caught the attack very, very quickly. So the impact was still significant, but much less than it would have been. It was an attempt at a ransomware, and that wasn't successful, but it did have a huge impact on the court for a short period of time. Part of what we have done, of course, part of this is in our increments, which I'll be getting to in just a moment, which is the software subscription. But we were able to purchase better security software than we had in the past. As you know, hackers are creative people, and software has to be constantly updated in order to stay ahead. Right now, we have what we think is a very, very robust system. But I'm sure we'll be back again with requesting money for the latest update, because it is a never-ending struggle and a never-ending cost. So, however, where we are right now, we were able to purchase some of that some of the computer equipment with that COVID money, because when we improved our system to be more accessible and to have more remote participation, we are also able to upgrade our system as being more secure, because when you have more outside participation, you have more opportunity for people to come into your computer system. And so when we were able to upgrade that with COVID money, we upgraded it with security as well. So I hope that answers your question. But I wish I could say we're done with security now, but unfortunately, I don't think we ever will be.
And I appreciate that answer, and you're right, we never will be. But it's good to hear that the system withstood the attack, and you're going to be ready for the next one, I'm confident. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative LeBron. Mr. Wolliver?
Okay, and this next slide, I'll talk a little bit more about that, because these are our proposed operating budget increment requests. And I'll just jump down to the $150,000 for evidence management software. Department of Law mentioned they're going more electronic with sharing of evidence. This is part of that same effort. We will have evidence management software in our courts so that attorneys don't bring in memory sticks to put into our computers. They don't have to. Everything can be shared and shared in a both between parties and for the court, and presented to the jurors, all without a security risk. But the biggest part, there are two biggest parts of our increment, are increased hours. We're moving about half of our work staff back to the full 37 and a half hour work week, and we will be opened for Friday afternoons for filing and for members of the public. The Chief Justice mentioned this in his State of the Judiciary address as well. We're looking to kind of step back, bring back half of our workload at this point, or of our workforce at this point, back to the full 37 and a half hours a week, for a couple of reasons. One, with the development of e-filing, it may be that we won't need as many of people working those hours. And plus, it is just, we just want to see how much better we can be with half the staff at that level. The other big thing we're doing is the software subscriptions. So you no longer just buy software, now you buy a subscription to software. So although last year we were able to pay the software subscriptions for the cybersecurity software and the COVID paid software that we had purchased, we were able to absorb that cost last year in our budget. But it's an ongoing expense, and so it's in our base. We're requesting to put that in our base. The other increments, facilities, operating maintenance costs, or increased leases. You know, our leases usually have a built-in consumer price index adjustment. The state for the public building fund is charging more this year. Utilities, things like that have all gone up. Our contracts for janitorial and security are going up. And then $136,000 for therapeutic court staff that fully funds a position in Bethel, and we've had some increased treatment costs as well. The $789,800 decrease is just our share of the PERS savings for this year. We are this year asking for a supplemental. We don't typically ask for a supplemental. As you can see, I've got a line through it because we will be amending our supplemental request. In the fall, we had worked with the governor's office in an effort to try to get through some of our backlog with cases, and the idea was we would be holding trials off-site in those court locations where the courtrooms themselves aren't big enough to socially distance all of the participants. And however, we've had enough savings now because trials, we were hoping to start the trials earlier. We had to delay it till January, so we had some more savings. So we'll be able to purchase the servers and software out of FY22 money. And the rest of the money, we're working with Ledge Finance and OMB to make that a multi-year appropriation. And those are the costs of having trials off-site associated with renting the facilities, putting up sound systems, and related costs, security, that type of thing. This, we hope to make this a multi-year, and then if it turns out that we just never end up doing a lot of off-site trials, this money will just lapse.
Representative Josephson.
Chair, Mr. Bolivar. When will we know, you said you're going to try and make it a multi-year term, when will that be known? I don't think it changes my disposition toward it much, but.
Actually, you know, because I haven't done a supplemental before, I'm not sure exactly at what point we amend our supplemental budget request. I can tell you we will be amending it, but okay. I'm not entirely sure.
New question.
Yes, Representative Josephson.
We've heard a lot through the chair. In every department about churn. I should know this because I oversee your budget, but remind me and the committee what that's like right now.
Well, we have two problems, and they are the same problems that everybody else is having. One is a lot of turnover, and two, difficulty. So it's recruitment and retention. Those are the two pieces. We've been affected by it as well, and it's compounded by the fact that we have a lot of positions that are not vacant, but the people are out on leave because of COVID-related issues, either childcare or their own status. We have implemented a few kind of incentive programs. We've changed the way we recruit, expanded the use a lot of public media in terms of recruiting. We've got an incentive program where if an employee recommend someone to the court, that and if the person, I think we've got, if they get hired, the employee gets a day off. If they meet their 6-month probation, they get another day off. And I think if it's there's enough, anyway, you can get up to 3 days off if you can direct someone to one of our positions, they get hired and are a good employee. So we're taking steps like that, but it is a challenge. And I happen to know a couple of judicial assistants who are, they're the administrative assistant for a judge. We just lost one longtime person because the pay in the private sector was just substantially higher. And I get, like Mr. Skidmore noted, we're not trying to compete necessarily with the private sector. There are benefits to working for the state, but it is harder and harder to get people to come to work for the state, as Representative Edgman noted earlier. It's affecting everybody. A year, in FY19, about this time, we had 35 vacancies. Now we've got 62 vacancies. So it is a problem for us.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
When you, so 35 and now 67?
62, I believe, although that was a few days ago. I'm
sure.
Fluctuate.
When you implement pay raises, you don't have to go through the Department of Administration. You're looking at what the trend line is for other departments with like work, something like that. Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, there is a statute, I don't remember the statute, but our pay needs to be comparable to the pay of other like employees in the state. And in terms of pay raises, as you know, all of our employees are non-covered employees, so we don't participate in the collective bargaining agreement, but the legislature has always given us the same or roughly the same pay raises or cost of living adjustments that are negotiated with the covered employees.
I see no further questions from the committee. Mr. Wilver, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And this concludes our business for today. Our next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, February 22nd at 1:30 p.m. We will have an overview from the Department of Environmental Conservation and an overview of the governor's budget amendments from OMB. And with that, we are adjourned at 3:12 p.m. Thank you.